Evening. Yeah, well, as was announced, I was in China until last Thursday. So I left about 3 weeks ago today. Exactly 3 weeks ago today. And the trip I was on was advertised as a trip to encounter the Dogen, the Ehe, the footsteps of Ehe Dogen, the Japanese teacher who went to China in the 1224, something like that, the year 1224, what we call the medieval times, to search for the true Zen. He felt like the true Zen was not present in Japan, and he felt something was missing. So he went to China to look for it. And so our trip was to follow in, to go to places where he went and where he encountered his teacher. And so we went to two places where that was so, where he went, and there are stories about him going there. And he talks about having gone to those two places, those two monasteries. And then the other part of the trip was an encounter with places that the poet, the Tang Dynasty poet Hanshan, had frequented. And so we went to two places where he is reputed to have showed up. He was a wilderness dwelling monk. He lived in. He didn't live steadily in a monastery. He lived up in the caves around a place called Tien Tai. But he would come down from time to time to the monasteries near there to potentially have some company and to meet with his good friend Shi De, who was living at Tien Tai Monastery. So we went to that monastery as well. What I didn't realize about the trip was that, as well as being an encounter with those personalities that I've been aware of for many years, it would be an encounter with the living tradition of Chinese Buddhism. What Chinese Buddhism today looks like. And I didn't quite appreciate how interesting that was going to be, how different from what I imagine Japanese Buddhism is, although I've never been to Japan, but since we follow in our practice approximate version of Japanese Buddhism. I have, I think, maybe more of a feel for what that might be like. But I really didn't have much of a feel for what Chinese Buddhism might look like these days. And I had never really thought about Chinese Buddhism today as a living tradition, which, in fact, it very much is. It's still in actually, I mean, it's as it has throughout history. Buddhism in China and elsewhere has had its, you know, periods of being suppressed and periods of flourishing. And right now in China, I would say that Buddhism is having a period of flourishing. Actually, it's permitted. It's one of the state religions. And, you know, as long as the monks do not protest in any way, do not protest against any government policies, which, of course, no one in China can do, they are allowed to have their practice, and monasteries appear to be flourishing, attracting lots of people, have a good number of monks there supporting them, as well as donors to make the monasteries, keep them up, keep them up, and even let them grow. So our first stop, our first encounter, and the theme of this talk was to talk about our encounters with Kuan Yin, or Guan Yin, or Guan Chi Yin, who is a bodhisattva of compassion in China, which we expected to have an encounter with because we went to the island of Putuoshan, which is otherwise known as Kuan Yin's Island. It's an island about not very far off the Chinese mainland in the East China Sea. It's actually almost connected by bridges to the mainland. There's only one island from which it is separated only by water, and you can only get to that from that island to Putuoshan by boat. But otherwise, the rest of the islands behind it are all connected by a series of bridges to the mainland. And they have a marketing slogan. For Putuoshan, any time it comes to your mind, come to Putuoshan. And you actually see this in English on billboards, as well, of course, as in Chinese characters. And this is unusual to see anything in English, and it's very unusual also to see anything that's remotely in correct syntax in English. Because the translations are not very good in many cases. But even before, on our trip, even before we got to the island, to Kuan Yin's Island, to see the many temples there that where there's living practice, we had a chance to visit a very famous temple in Shanghai on our first day there, called the Jade Buddha Temple. And Karen went to that temple on a trip she took in 2005. It's a sort of almost required stop of anybody who's pilgrimaging to China, and especially if you're going to be in Shanghai, because they have a very famous, beautiful Jade Buddha. Not exceptionally big. I saw many huge Buddhas there, but this Jade Buddha in particular is not that big. But it's present in the context of a large monastery, and so I just wanted to give you a little sense of what a large monastery is like in China. First of all, it is large, and everything about it is so much more so much bigger than anything that we're used to seeing. I mean, some of us have been to, for instance, Green Gulch, and we think that's quite a big zendo and quite a large facility for the practice of Buddhism. And after being in China, I feel like it's a small Dharma center. It's basically a small Dharma center. It only has one hall for practice. Are you kidding me? I mean, in these monasteries in China, I mean, they have 5, 6, 8 halls for practice, and mostly not sitting meditation practice, mind you, but halls for doing services to the various Buddhas or with the various Buddhas that are present in those halls, and oftentimes not Jade Buddha Temple, but oftentimes the temples are set up. This the most common configuration is that they will be set up ascending a hill, so that when you enter on one level, which you enter an entry hall where there's a Manjushri figure, which amazingly to me, I was very amazed to realize that sort of almost comical to me, fat Buddha that you see that we call Hotai, or that big laughing Buddha. That image is actually present in many of the monasteries and in the entry hall. And I was really surprised to see that. And did I say Manjushri?
Yeah.
I made a mistake. It's Maitreya. That's the image they consider to be Maitreya Buddha. And I was just really surprised because I kind of thought that was some sort of popular, you know, popularized version of some sort of jolly Saint Nick type of Buddha, but it is not. It's an object of it's a Buddha of veneration in China, and it took me. I don't think I fully got over my sort of surprise about that, and it wasn't my favorite image to gaze upon. Somehow, it just doesn't have the right vibe to me, but
your conditioning.
But my conditioning, and one thing I have to say is you know, it's hard, it's impossible actually to not let your perceptions be colored by your cultural context, and your understanding to be colored by your cultural context. So anything I say about what I encountered there is. Or any opinion that I might have is really still completely uninformed. One of the reasons being that you can't have a conversation. I can't have a conversation with anybody there who's practicing, and to really get in on at any depth at all. I can't get in depth of where's the bathroom with them. I can't get into anything with people there because of the language barrier is so virtually absolute. All our encounters that we had were through our Chinese guide. They were all translated, and you can't really know that you know that the guide was perfectly capable. But for instance, when we were talking with one abbot the abbot talked for 5 minutes, and then our guide talked for 30 seconds about what he said. And it was hard to believe that we were getting all of the nuances of what that encounter was. So it's a significant, unless you're competent in the language, to say that you went to China and understood something about Chinese Buddhism is, whatever I've probably understood is very superficial, actually, at this point. But nevertheless, I saw things with my eyes. So I will tell you about some things I saw with my eyes. And so I was talking about the configuration of the monastery. So you have the entry hall, usually with Maitreya in there. And then the next hall will always be the Buddha hall. And you'll walk through, and all of the halls have entrances front and rear. They're all open. There's no doors. It's a subtropical climate, so there's no doors. I never saw any doors. Maybe there were some doors, but I don't remember any ever being closed. There might have been some there, but they were always open because I was there when the monastery was open, right? So you walk through the one hall, out the back of it, and into the Buddha hall, and the Buddha hall. The very common configuration, and this is what we saw in the Jade Buddha Temple, is they'll be either in that hall, they'll either be Shakyamuni Buddha, a huge image, usually, 20 feet would be a good round number of that Buddha. And they'll usually be Shakyamuni Buddha or their Manjushri Buddha, Manjushri Bodhisattva. I'm take that back. It had to be Buddha because it's the Buddha hall. So it has to be a Buddha when you come in. It has to be some Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha probably. Yeah.
What the Buddha hall has, the Buddha is in what, is standing or sitting?
Almost always sitting. Sometimes standing though. Sometimes in a standing posture.
And did they have a consistent mudra or was it?
No, various. Oftentimes touching the earth, actually. Touching the earth mudra. So one hand down. I don't remember what the other hand's doing in the touching the earth mudra, but oftentimes the one hand down is fairly typical. And then what you'll have is, and this is what we saw, the first Buddha hall that we saw in Shanghai, on the back side of so back to back, in other words, in that hall, Buddha in front, Guanyin in back, and that's the way it was at Jade Buddha Temple. And Guanyin is almost all, if she's in the back, she's almost always standing. And she's standing in the center, and there's usually two large figures, not quite as big as her, looking on adoringly, almost looking on adoringly, because she is a bodhisattva of compassion. She's radiating compassion and mercy. And oftentimes these figures are childlike. And so Karen brought a gift that I gave her, which is a little traveling Guanyin, and it's a triptych, and so it's got Guanyin riding a dragon, which is oftentimes how she is configured in the image, or a fish, some like she's standing on a fish's head, because she's also the protecting saint of mariners, sailors. So she's often in the waves, and riding a fish, standing. And then the most amazing part of it is, so you got Guanyin in the middle, two adoring figures, and then a backdrop, a bas-relief backdrop, that in this one hall at least went up 30 or 40 feet, and is wide, and with all sorts of creatures living on it. You know, in bas-relief. And my presumption was that these are all the beings that Guanyin is protecting, is providing protection to, because that is her main mission. Of course, I keep saying her with reference to Guanyin, because, of course, the famous and well-known transition for that bodhisattva who's called Avalokiteshvara in India is that in China she starts out as male, but is today always depicted as female. So that's the big thing that happens in China, is that this bodhisattva becomes depicted as female and referenced as female. So that particular iconography, that particular iconography is very common to see Guanyin, some Buddha on the front and then Guanyin on the back. And then so there's another temple. So you go out that door, and then you have to go some more steps, and then you might find, and this when we went to Putoshan, we found this, and then there's a whole hall that's devoted to Guanyin, and she's on the front altar. So we went from Shanghai, we flew to Putoshan, or to the island that's near it, took a boat over there, and the first temple that we visited is the largest temple there, and it's called Chan Puji Temple, or Chan Puji Monastery, and it means the Zen Hall of Universal Compassion, Zen Hall of Universal Compassion, and it's the largest one. And it has in the third hall, it has a sitting Guanyin figure, and all of the temples, I think, on that island have a hall that's just devoted to Guanyin. And sometimes that's all they have. As you go up the mountain, and this is a mountain, so not only do these various buildings ascend, and each monastery ascend the mountain, then they have one monastery, and then you walk up some more or take a bus up some more, and there's another monastery which climbs the mountain, and then you go yet a third time, and we walked actually from the second temple, which is called Fa Yu Temple. We walked from that monastery up to the final monastery, actually, which is just a temple. There's no, I don't think monks live there because it's pretty small. And then there's also a cable car that goes up there. So we walked, some of us walked up, as you know, an act of devotional devotion to that highest monastery, and then we took the cable car down. So you know, there's this really strong sense of ascent in this whole configuration, especially on Putrashan. So I wanted to say something about what I saw in terms of practice there, and there's a real strong a sense that of a devotional flavor of practice for people coming from the outside. As I mentioned, these monasteries, especially on Putrashan, this is a major tourist destination for the Chinese. We didn't see very many Westerners there at all. I don't really recall seeing any, to tell you the truth. Maybe there were a few. But it is a major destination for Chinese tourism and for people that have some feeling of faith. According to our guide, all Chinese monasteries today are a combination of Pure Land Buddhism and Zen. And so there's that mix. And so you have people coming who, I'd say the most people that are coming are not people that cross their legs and sit meditation. They are mostly people who are coming to pay their respects, make their devotional offerings. And those devotional offerings can range from, now visually, this is all I saw, from what appears to be very shallow and very, you know, not very deep, not very sincere. The least sincere thing I saw that appeared to me to be rather insincere was that people would take coins and try to land them on a certain place on an incense, a really large incense urn that was not in use, and it had various apertures in it. And so, you know, there would be people, it's almost like a carnival game, flipping coins into various apertures of this large. And I don't know if they were thinking of that as a devotional act or not, but it seemed rather crass to me. But again, I'm not of that culture, so maybe that was just part of it. I don't really know. But then you would see some what looked like more sincere acts of devotion. People going into the temples, bowing in front of the Buddhas. They have this habit, or this one thing that's unfamiliar to us, is they take their gassho, which is usually held. I got corrected. I was holding my gassho like this, right? And this Chinese guy came up to me and said, no, mm-hmm. You know, like this, you kind of keep it open. You make a little aperture there in your mudra there. And so what they'll do is they'll hold it like that, and they'll shake it. They'll like this. It'll be, and they may be saying, Amitofo, Amitofo, Amitofo. And they may be saying that quietly, or sometimes it'll break out in a group of people. And this is, they're chanting the name of Amitabha Buddha, the Buddha of the Pure Land. So there's a lot of Pure Land connection with the practice there. I might mention that in all the monasteries we saw, we only physically saw one Zen hall, one place where there was sitting, a place for sitting, and we were allowed in that place, actually, and we were able to sit in there for a little while, which was a real special dispensation. But we were told there's always a Zen hall off somewhere. We were also told that only a few monks kind of devote themselves to Zazen, and the rest of the monks are devoting themselves to doing services. So that's, but well, you know, as far as we could see, what we were seeing was monks who were devoting themselves to devotional services. But then, just kind of to wrap up the thing of the devotional acts that we saw, the most sincere, and this to me, again, from my you know, very biased cultural standpoint, looked like it veered off into the kind of harsh devotional side of things. What people would do is they would take the ferry over. Groups of people, some groups, would take the ferry over from the one island. They would get off the boat, and they would start making three steps, and then a full bow to the ground. Three steps, a full bow to the ground, and so on. And they would do this all the way up on Putrashan. There's a giant. They call it. The Colossus, the giant coin, you know, that was put up not so many years ago, actually. It's all gold. I don't know if it's as tall as the Statue of Liberty, but I mean, it's really, really big. It's really, really big. And it's outside, and it's on a point of land looking out over the sea. And so there's people taking three steps, full bow to the ground, getting up three steps, full bow to the ground, wearing gloves, wearing knee pads. And I saw a group of people who were doing this, and they must have started in the morning. It's about, I would say it's about 2 miles from the ferry, to maybe a little more, 2-3 miles, I don't know, from the ferry to the place where this Colossus is, where they do this. And I saw a group that was just about to reach. This was late afternoon. They were just about to reach this big statue, and I looked at their faces. I was walking out at that time, and these people were hurting so much. I mean, they were so tired, and they were in so much pain, and I could just you know, again, from my perspective, it didn't, I mean, this is the Bodhisattva of mercy, you know. And so I don't know. It just seemed really harsh to me that they were doing this to themselves, because you could tell it was just really painful at that point for them. They'd probably done 1,000 vows or more by that time. By the time they got up to the top of the hill, but that is a practice that's routinely done there every day. There's people coming and doing that practice. We saw walking up from one of the monasteries to the very higher monasteries, we saw people doing that on that, and that's on steps, on stone steps, and they're walking and then they're bowing on the steps, and the three steps and bowing on the steps. So it's a pretty ascetic practice. So the other thing that was kind of amazing on Putrashan is we saw our first service. We saw a service being conducted in the Buddha Hall, and you know, we have these instruments. Oh, I guess they already got put away. Anyway, we have these instruments we use in our services, like a big bell and a small bell. And these are like toys compared to what they had. They have a makugyo, which is a wooden fish that, I don't know, I was going to say it was about as big as a smart car. I mean, the thing is just huge. I mean, and they have a guy playing it. He uses two hands, you know, he's got a big grip, and he uses two hands and keeping the time for the chanting. And then the guy hitting the bell has also got, you know, he's got just a huge, you know, he can barely grip the striker. And when the bell is 6 feet tall, I mean, at least 6 feet tall. And they had a drum they were hitting that you had to climb a ladder to be able to hit it. Because to get to the center of the drum, which is where you want to hit it, you had to climb a fairly many steps. Because the face of the drum was 10 feet in diameter. It's just amazing. And of course, this all goes with, you know, 20-foot Buddha or 25-foot Buddha. So it all works, you know.
But how many people would be there, you know, doing their devotional at one
time. So there'd be about, in this particular service, that we actually participated in one service, and we did the standing service, an hour and a half. And we did one at Tien Tong. We participated. We couldn't join the chanting, of course, so, but we could enjoy it. We joined the bowing, and there was plenty of that. They do have some very nice bowing platforms that are raised, so you don't have to go all the way down to the floor. It's kind of compassionate, I thought, because they do a lot of bowing there. But you know, on this Fuji temple, there was probably 40, 50 monks doing the service, and then it's a tourist site, so there's people coming in and out all the time, and it's kind of like they're somewhat carrying on, like, you know, their conversations and so forth, so it's a little random. But what I did was I recorded some of the service, and I wanted to play it for you to give you...
Excuse me, Jim, I was wondering, maybe you don't need to plug it in. If you hold it in front of that microphone, wouldn't that amplify it already?
I think that when that feedback, like, crazy?
Maybe.
You might be lucky, you might not.
I don't think it will. I think I should plug it in. You'll get a better feeling.
So you couldn't chant with them, Jim?
No, it's in Chinese. And we didn't know the chants.
No Japanese.
They didn't pass out chant.
I was
going to
say.
No, they didn't pass out chant card. They're chanting here the Sharangama mantra. It's a mantra that has 554 lines, and they memorize it.
Right.
And nobody's using a chant card. Not all the monks have fully memorized it, but there is a few lead monks that have to have it memorized, and a couple of them have microphones,
mm-hmm.
and so they can, you know, project more with their microphones. Let me see if this works. You can see why I couldn't chant.
And those 554 lines that last about a half hour, or
that's not the only chant they chant. Is that, I don't know, maybe you're gonna have to adjust the volume again. I messed with the volume. Is that still recording my voice?
Yeah.
Okay. That's not the Sharangama mantra isn't the only one they chant. So they'll chant the Heart Sutra and other chants that, but actually Mio was there with me, as you know, and he recognized the Heart Sutra, but I didn't recognize it. I couldn't recognize it. They chanted in a different rhythm and a different, with instruments that we don't use and in a different language. And so I couldn't recognize it. But he said, Mio was the one that said, this is the Sharangama mantra. And that isn't. It's also called the heroic mark scripture. And I read something at the beginning of Zazen, which is from a case in the Book of Serenity that references the heroic mark scripture, which is not. I was thinking that, well, why didn't Dogen bring the heroic march scripture, back to Japan? I'm not aware that, it's part of our Zen practice anywhere. And I remembered that actually Dogen wasn't in China that long, and it might be that he couldn't learn the Sharangama mantra in that amount of time. It was present, definitely, in that time. It's been around for a long time. But it's very common in the practice of Chinese Buddhism, and I wondered. So then coming back, well, because I'm not very familiar with that scripture, I thought, well, what's the connection? Is there any connection to Guanyin? And so I looked up a translation, a very accessible translation by Master Hua, who was a big. I don't know if you've ever heard of the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Ukiah, but he was sort of a Suzuki Roshi-like person who came to the U.S. and promulgated Chinese Buddhism, and he has set up communities and quite a few followers in this country of that. That version, that monastic practice that comes out of China. So anyway, I was looking to see, is there some, connection? I was curious, coming back, is there some connection between the Sharangama mantra and Guanyin? Is that a reason why it's chanted in some of these temples? And I can't answer that question directly, but there is... There is definitely a connection, because in that sutra, or in that scripture, which also, by the way, is another one of these that's probably of Chinese origin, rather than, even though it's called a sutra, and even though it says, thus I have heard and all that stuff, I think the verdict is that it was probably written in China around the 8th century. Nevertheless, it has all the characters that you might be familiar with from other sutras, including Ananda and a number of sages, including the early sages who, the first five who followed Shakyamuni Buddha. So there's this part in the Sharangama Sutra which I did not read the whole thing because it's quite long. But I did scroll through to a part that I thought was of interest to our practice and to Guanyin. There's a point where the Buddha responds to a question from Ananda, who's asked, which of the constituent elements should I use to break through to enlightenment? If you remember the story of Ananda, he was Mahakashapa, just saw the flower, was held up, and he became the first enlightened disciple. And Ananda, had to take a little bit more time to break through. So he's asking the Buddha, which of the constituent elements should I use to break through? And if the constituent elements are the same ones that we chant in the Heart Sutra, six senses, six sense objects, and six sense consciousnesses, right? So eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, sight, sound, color, taste, touch, tangibles, mind, and so forth. Mind, and then the consciousnesses that go with all of those. And so the Buddha doesn't answer him directly. He turns to all these sages that are present, and he asks each of the ones, well, which ones did you use to break through to enlightenment? And so they all give their answers, and each one says that concentrating on, the eye is the best, and it's the best, and concentrating on the ear is the best, and the other one says concentrating on the sense of smell is the best, and so forth. They all say their sense faculty or sense consciousness or sense object that they concentrated on is the very best one and the best way to break through to enlightenment. And so the final sage to answer the question is Avalokiteshvara or Guanyin. And so Guanyin enters samadhi through the practice of hearing, through the practice of listening. So you might know, I think probably all of you know, that Guanyin is the one that hears the cries of the world. So she has developed this way of listening inward. And by that way of listening inward, she can hear the sorrows and the needs of all beings. So I want to read this little part from the Sharangama Sutra where she explains how she listens within, and because of that practice and the stillness that comes from that practice, she's able to then listen to the sorrows of the world. It says, I began with a practice based on the enlightened nature of hearing. First, I redirected my hearing inward in order to enter the current of the sages. That should sound quite familiar, right? First, I directed my hearing inward in order to enter the current of the sages. Then, external sounds disappeared. With the direction of my hearing reversed, and with sounds stilled, both sounds and silence ceased to arise. So it was that I gradually progressed. What I heard and my awareness of what I heard came to an end. ... I left out some stuff. The ultimate silence was revealed. All of a sudden, I transcended the worlds of ordinary beings, and I also transcended the worlds of beings who have transcended the ordinary worlds. Everything in the 10 directions was fully illuminated, and I gained 2 remarkable powers. First, my mind ascended to unite with the fundamental, wondrous, enlightened mind of all Buddhas in the 10 directions, and my power of compassion became the same as theirs. Second, my mind descended to unite with all beings of the 6 destinies in all 10 directions, such that I felt their sorrows and prayerful yearnings as my own. I was then able to appear in 32 forms that respond to what beings require. Second, my mind descended. I'm reading this again. Second, my mind descended to unite with all beings of the 6 destinies. That's the 6 realms of existence. In all 10 directions, such that I felt their sorrows and prayerful yearnings as my own. So when I read that, I thought, this shows that the practice of empathy, this is a bodhisattva practice, to be able to feel to actually feel the sorrows of others, the yearnings of others as your own, is a bodhisattva practice. To practice empathy is a bodhisattva practice, and it's apparently a practice that comes about with awakening. It comes up with awakening, and so I was just thinking that, you know, when I read that, I thought, okay, this is important for us to this is an important teaching that we receive from Kuan Yin, that by turning that our practice, I mean, and Reb's been talking about this recently, how you transform the world, and he insists that our practice of turning the light inward, you know, she talks about turning hearing inward. Dogen talks about, our other teachers talk about turning the light of awareness inward. That practice of turning the light inward is actually the most effective. That's the most effective method for developing these powers of empathy and power of compassion. Going up and getting the power of compassion, descending down and seeing the sorrows and yearnings of beings. So this, to me, like, is the connection between Zen, you know, and this kind of devotional part, you know, this kind of devotional side of Buddhism that we see in China, because you can't really be devoted, you know, the best way to be devoted to beings, to, you know, to really hear beings and to be devoted to them and be empathetic with them and hear their sorrows and yearnings, is to be effective in that. The best way is to practice turning the light inward. So this is you know, the merging of the Chan approach, you know, the Zen approach, and maybe this. This devotional, this idea of being devoted to beings, being devoted to the welfare of others. We need to turn the light inward in order to do that, in order to have that kind of devotional energy, because otherwise we're depleted by it. You know, we can't do it really if we aren't able to turn the light inward and be sustained by our practice of turning light inward. I think it's very hard to be empathetic. So we constantly renew ourselves, through our practice, so that we can hear the yearnings and sorrows of others, which are, you know, always coming our way. Not turning away from that is made possible by our practice. Oh, perfect. So, you know, I don't know if that's an important thing to mention. I'll just mention it because I was kind of curious. One of the things, you know, she says here, she appears in 32 forms. So there's a list of 32 forms that Guanyin appears in. And for instance, if there's a monk who wants to be a monk but has some problems about being a monk, then Guanyin appears as a monk and teaches the Dharma from the perspective of a monk and for the benefit of a monk. And similarly, if there's a king, the king that's having problems ruling or doing his kingly thing, then Guanyin appears as a king and teaches the Dharma from the perspective of a king. So again, this is all, you know, this is the idea that we can actually transform ourselves into a being that is like identical with other beings. One of the things that we saw, which was very curious, and I wondered about it when I read this, and this was just an oddity, is we saw people throwing, I kept hearing this noise, clattering noise in the Buddha hall when those monks were chanting. Once in a while I'd hear this big clatter. And what it was they were throwing divination tiles on the floor. And they were like, because Guanyin is also a granter of wishes. I mean, this is also, you don't know what you're seeing. I mean, people, maybe you're there praying for, you know, a better boyfriend, a better girlfriend, a child, and actually says in the sutra, you know, that you can pray, you can go to Kuan Yin and you can pray for a girl child, or you can pray for a boy child, you can pray for a, you know, she'll grant your wish of a spouse. But one of the forms that she can appear in is to beings who would like to employ numerology in other esoteric disciplines out of a wish to protect and nurture themselves. I will appear as a Brahmin. I will instruct them in dharmas that will lead them to the fulfillment of their wish. And I wondered if that being there is partly why these people were in there throwing the divination tiles on the stone floor while the service was going on right in front of the Buddha, and also why it was completely okay that they were doing that. You know,
those weren't monks doing
it. No, these were visitors. These were visitors doing that, and it was completely okay that they were doing it. So, this is part of this like sort of chaotic and a little bit wild situation that's going on.
It reminds you a little bit of how Buddhism molds itself around the local culture. Every continent gets a different version. It just gets remolded a bit.
Yeah.
But it doesn't just throw out everything and put in the Buddhism.
Yeah.
It's the culture, the whole culture is right there.
Yeah. And the only things that you couldn't do in there, I mean, you could talk. The people were, you probably heard people mm-hmm. talking in the background of that chanting. Mm-hmm. People were in there talking. They didn't want pictures taken, but I had my cell phone out, and the guy said, no, no, no. But I was just recording, and he didn't understand. So I put it away, and then I pulled it out again, and because I really wanted a recording of that. I mean, you heard it. It had this hypnotic quality, that chanting. Very, yeah, it's very rhythmic. It really has a very nice rhythm to it, and I'm sure it's the rhythm that helps them memorize 554 lines. And it was only, you know, these guys with the mics that I was sure knew this, because you could see some mumbling going on and some of the other monks, but so it's an entirely different presentation of the practice, but the big role of the clergy there is clearly, we saw a lot of instances of services being done for families. So there's a big role that the clergy there has in doing that in the monasteries. And we actually, the service that we went to and participated in for an hour and a half was a service for a family that was there, and they were doing the service with, and they were offered opportunities to offer incense and do various things during the service. So that's really, really, really common.
Or a death, or...
I don't know. Probably it was either the anniversary of the death, or somebody sick, or it's hard to know. But presumably, it wasn't celebratory. I'm sure it was like on the behalf of someone in sorrow or with some yearning for something to fulfill some wish, to fulfill or obligation. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Did they find it curious that Americans, Buddhists were there? Did you have any, or were they just accepting that?
Well, we went in a lot of places where Westerners don't go that much. And so we were a subject of some curiosity and interest. And on Putrashan, one woman in our group who was, and it wasn't because she's a woman or anything like that, she had a Kuan Yin t-shirt on as we were walking up from Fa Yu to this top temple that I can't remember the name of. She had a Kuan Yin t-shirt, and several people stopped her and asked to have their picture taken with her. And several people stopped me in various places and asked to have their picture taken with me. So we're used to like going, probably most Americans think, well, I go to other countries and I take pictures of the natives or whatever. Well, there, I felt it was a great turnaround. I felt like, good, take your picture with me. Yeah, I'll take your picture all the time, you know. Because I felt it was a great turnaround to be a subject of curiosity or interest by another culture when I'm clearly, you know, I'm not part of that culture. And I really appreciated the opportunity to sort of have that turnaround and be a subject of curiosity and interest and weirdness, you know. Oh, weird.
Yeah. Do they, are they really solemn when they take their pictures? Like, I traveled in Indonesia and had the experience of being an oddity, and I have probably 50 pictures of myself and a group of 20 people because I would say, here, take my camera and take the picture too.
Uh-huh.
And they'd be joking and laughing, and then they'd come to take the picture, and everybody was very solemn.
Very solemn?
Yeah.
I don't remember that aspect or not. I only happened to me really a couple of times to have my picture taken with somebody, but and it's usually their camera, so I don't know what they were doing. I was looking at the camera and smiling probably, and that'll probably be another object of curiosity.
Yeah.
Why is he smiling? Do you have a question, Oscar?
I was wondering how large your party was.
Well, we were very lucky. We had a very small group. We only had 12, including the guides. So I didn't mention that we had a Chinese guide named Eric Liu, who was the same person that was the guide on Karen's trip, kind of specializes in Western Zen groups. And then Kaz Tanahashi, who's a scholar and a longtime person at the San Francisco Zen Center, and Peter Levitt, who is a poet and who has collaborated on with Kaz on a new edition of the Shobogenzo, and also they're coming out with a book of Hanshan's, complete Hanshan poems. And I'm going to talk about that next week, their contributions on Hanshan poems. And I did bring also, I brought some bling back for the Sangha, and I'll bring it next week to show. I forgot, I had it all ready to go, and apparently forgot it tonight. So
are they coins pilfered from an incense holder by any chance?
No, they aren't. And no.
They're tools.
They're tools. They're liturgical instruments. That's it. So, I'm sorry. I didn't bring back. I was tempted, I'll tell you. They had some big Makugyos, but I thought, how would I get it home? You know? It was tempting, but it didn't seem feasible to get it on the bus. So,
I might mention that when I was in China on the Kuan Yin tour, the San Francisco Zen Center, well, at least the people from Green Gulch, bought a Kuan Yin statue, maybe about that tall or so, which now does sit at the back of the Buddha at Green Gulch.
Yeah.
So that was kind of sweet.
And that really now that totally made sense to me why you and how great it was that they put her on the back, because it's just like they do in China. And the great thing about it too is you always came into that zendo to the back of the Manjushri Bodhisattva, and now you come into the front of the Kuan Yin. So actually, which is unusual, you wouldn't have it that way in China, probably. But it's great to have it done that way, so that you come in and you know that when you bow. you're really, you know, you're bowing to a bodhisattva. But it made sense to me, you know, to see it on, now I really appreciate how it's on the back of the altar, which is the way it is in China, too. I don't know if it's that way in Japan or not, but I think...
There's one woman who had to carry it wrapped the whole way.
Really? On the plane and everything?
Yeah, they didn't check it.
Well, I bought a very much smaller going in there, but that was my order anyway, to get a travel Kuan Yin, so I was able to finally get that. Well, thank you very much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to tell you about my travels, and I'll tell you a little bit more next week about Tiantong Monastery and Tiantai Monastery and the amazing Ming'an Monastery. Maybe I'll try to bring some pictures next week, because that place is was mind-blowing. Nobody in the trip had ever been there, including our Chinese guide. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, one more question.
How many monks live in residence?
The only count I got was at Tiantong, they had 130 monks living there. I don't know the rest of the monks. We had an interview with the abbot there, and we were able to, you know, to get a little deeper into a few things there. But
did you wear any robes?
I did. At that monastery, I wore I wore a robe. I didn't take my okesa, so I just took this. But I have a light Chinese robe that I wore. Myo wore his. He has a light Chinese robe, and he brought an okesa. And he wore that, and they put him right up at the front of the line. And they put me next to him, because we were the only ones in robes. This is the one time we did service. And then they put the rest of the people, you know, after us. Because, oh, they put me up there right away. Oh, they pointed at me. Yeah, get over there. Yeah, you look good. You look like you belong. And he did. He very much enjoyed the trip, too,
good.
which I was... happy about. So to be continued. I have more to say next week.